Thursday Arts Preview receives support from Spokane Media Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering lending and banking services to professionals in film, marketing, performing arts, and more. Information online at smfcu.org.
Welcome to the Thursday Arts Preview, where the P is parenthetical. I'm your host, EJ Iannelli. Fleabag meets Lizzie McGuire is how a new Spokane-based short film called Untouchable is billing itself. A little later in this episode, we'll talk to the producer of Untouchable, Rachel Baker, about the film, which grew out of a one-woman comedy show. We'll start this week with a view of the heavens. A new exhibition at the Confluence Gallery in Twisp is celebrating the majesty of the rural night sky. Titled Dark Skies, the exhibition features 28 artists capturing that theme in a variety of media, including paintings, photography, textiles, and sculpture. Through an educational partnership with the Metau Dark Skies Coalition, it's also meant to get us thinking about the consequences of light pollution. Dark Skies and its sister exhibition, Bright Skies, opened this past weekend at the Confluence Gallery, and I spoke with artist Janet Fagan, who's curating both of them, about what patrons can expect. You know, and before we start talking about your curation of this exhibition, I'd like to know some of your background. You do block printing, is that right?
I do, yes. I'm both a painter and a printmaker, and I combine the two mediums into mixed media pieces, but I also use each media, block printing and painting, as standalone images as well.
And what is your association with the Confluence? I'm assuming you've exhibited there in the past?
Yes, I have been fortunate enough to be, a pretty long-term exhibitor at the Confluence at this point. I guess I go back about 15 years there. And I also sit on the board right now, and I'm a volunteer on the show committee, and that's how I came to curate the Dark Skies exhibit.
And tell me a little bit about the Confluence as a gallery. What sort of vibe does it have? Does it have certain priorities? You know, because each gallery takes on its own flavor. So what is the flavor of the Confluence?
Oh, my goodness. That's a great question. One of the things that really attracted me to moving to the Metau Valley is the Confluence and the arts community in general in the Valley. But the Confluence is really special because it is a very community-minded gallery. It is largely supported by a really strong volunteer base that really love the arts. And this includes artists and non-artists, all kinds of different professionals. But there's a really wonderful vibe of everybody supporting artists and making sure that lots of different people, no matter where they are on their path in the arts, that they have opportunities to be seen and be heard. So I love the gallery for that reason, among many others, but it's incredibly impressive. If you just look at the roster of shows for the year that are coming up, you have everything from like the current exhibit that Mary Powell has up right now. She's a longtime Valley artist, and she's a deep professional with huge roots in the arts, and she has a solo show. But she's coming on the heels of Rose Wiegand's show of her advanced art class, her high school students. So, I mean, you have juxtapositions like that that are really wonderful that you just don't see in many other professional galleries. And the Confluence has been around for 35 years, which is huge. That is a huge lifespan for a gallery.
And is it pretty Twisp-centric or Metau-centric?
I would say neither. There definitely is a priority to exhibit local artists and to honor the local community, but there are artists that come from all over the globe to exhibit at the Confluence. It's pretty amazing. It has a very far reach, and the reputation that it has on the West Side is pretty stellar.
That's really cool because, you know, some of the exhibitions that you were describing sounded very community-centric or community-oriented. Mm-hmm. And then that's, I guess, also balanced out by artists of international and national recognition.
Yes, and that's a really tricky line to walk. And that really speaks to the quality of the directorships that we've had. There just have been wonderful people at the helm that make sure that not only do we support the local artists and make sure that they have a voice and a place to show their work. But we also get the word out, and people learn about the quality of the exhibits and the heart behind the gallery, which I think is really what pulls artists in. The Confluence, part of their mission statement is to actually educate as well as exhibit. So mentoring artists, like for instance, in this show, we have a handful of artists that are exhibiting for the first time in the Dark Skies exhibit, I mean, and mentoring them when they have questions like, well, you know, I've never been in a professional exhibit before. How do I frame my work? Or what does a bio look like? You know, how do I wire the back of my painting? you get questions like that. And it's a real pleasure to be able to, as a curator or as, you know, a volunteer or staff person at the Confluence, it's our pleasure to answer those questions and help people to step up. That's not something that you get at many galleries.
You kind of think that arts education exists for the public's benefit, but as you mentioned, artists need to be educated themselves just in the basic protocols of showing.
Exactly. And you just don't get a lot of that in art school. Or if you've, you know, had another career and you're getting into arts for the first time, you know, you can rely on your friends to help you, but there aren't a lot of avenues for artists to really learn the ropes of what they need to do to walk the path into the professional realm.
Yeah, so let's talk about this Dark Skies exhibition. And I think you've got 28 artists who are showing. And as you mentioned, some of them are just starting out. But mm-hmm. I'm curious as to how you came to curate this. Was this something that came up and you put your hand up? Or was this something that you brought to the Confluence and said, hey, I've got this exhibition in mind. Can I curate it?
Yeah, the latter. Well, first of all, the Confluence operates with a show committee and everyone can bring ideas to the table and then the ideas get voted on. So I was really interested in curating an exhibit that focused on dark skies because, you know, I'm just struck by the darkness that we have in the Med-Al. And I grew up in a small town on the coast of Florida where we also had that same ability to really see the night sky with very minimal light pollution. So I've always valued that, and it's something that inspires my work, and I know I'm not alone. I know there's a lot of artists out there that really pull from the natural world to inspire their artwork, especially here in the Valley. And I thought, you know, why don't we give artists a chance to really focus on one element of the natural world and then also have a component where we can not only inspire people by sharing what moves us, but also educate ourselves and equip ourselves and others to be good stewards of what inspires us. So that was kind of the nugget of my idea for this show is how can we show what moves artists, but also empower everyone to take really good care of our natural world, especially thinking about the skies in the same way we might think about air quality or water quality, that it is something that can be diminished, but it doesn't have to be. We can take active steps to help preserve and protect the beauty of the dark skies.
Yeah, and I think this encompasses a variety of media. So you got paintings, photography, mm-hmm. textile, sculpture.
Yeah.
I'd really like to get some idea of the works that are on display, and not just the media, but how artists are going and approaching this single theme, because I'm assuming that it's not just going to be infinite representations of dark skies, but there are going to be some really really interesting takes on this.
Oh, absolutely. This exhibit is super exciting in that, so for instance, Dan Brown is a name that, you know, you might be familiar with. He's a really well-known sculptor, and he is recognized for creating really beautiful, large mixed media sculptures. So in this case, he has just completely outdone himself. He has three pieces in the show that are actual constellations. And I don't want to give too much away, but I'll just say that they will appeal to people that know what they're looking for when they look up. And they also have a lot of whimsy and just artistic beauty in them as well. So I'll just kind of leave that as a teaser because they are definitely worth coming in to see. They're magnificent. Juxtaposed against that, we have a couple of different fabric artists, which you don't typically get a lot of textile work. You know, painters are usually the most represented. And so to have several fabric artists in this show is really wonderful. So we have some really beautiful textile pieces, some really luminous watercolors, oil paintings, some incredible clay works, some pottery. So there's a pretty wide swath of media in this exhibit.
And you'd mentioned Dan Brown by name, but I didn't know if you wanted to mention anyone else by name. And I know curators are reluctant to maybe show favorites or mention favorites, but is there another work that really stood out to you that you think, man, I can't wait until patrons see this?
Oh, gosh. I'm going to give a shout out to Bonnie Smurden. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name correctly because I have not met her yet, but it's S-M-E-R-D-O-N. And she has three pieces in the exhibit that are a combination of collage and painting, and they are absolutely exquisite. And she has never shown in the Confluence before that I'm aware of, and so I just want to give her a little shout out because her pieces are really wonderful. And then I also want to mention, because I think this is an interesting crossover that's happening with this exhibit, we have a lot of first-time exhibitors that are mainly in the sciences, and they're throwing their hat into the ring because they're crossing over into sharing their inspiration. You know, they're typically sharing their knowledge as biologists or scientists. But David Lucas, for example, he has his first debut in a professional gallery in this exhibit. And he has a beautiful photograph that he has on display. So Bonnie Smurden is a more professional artist that is clearly, you know, familiar with the ropes of exhibiting. And then David is at the very beginning of his path exhibiting his work. And so I love that both of them are sharing space in the same exhibit.
Oh, and that harks back to the whole mission of the Confluence, which is to make sure that mm-hmm. underrepresented artists or beginning artists are also getting an opportunity as well. And I have to ask, did any of these folks who are showing for the first time come out of the partnership with the Metau Dark Sky Coalition? Because I know that they're an educational partner for this.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not positive of this, but I'm pretty sure that's how David Lucas heard about the exhibit. And then our postcard artist is on the team that makes up the Metau Dark Sky Coalition. And his name is Jack McLeod. And he has a piece called Night Watch that's the postcard piece for the exhibit.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So that's exciting.
Yeah, it really is. And these partnerships with like-minded organizations, you know, you can all make art kind of a rallying point.
Yes, absolutely. And we're going to take it just a little bit further by having a panel discussion during the show on March 21st. And we're going to have scientists, photographers, someone representing the indigenous population, sculptor, and then someone that also has lived in a fire lookout. So all of these different perspectives on the night sky. And I think that's going to be a really fun evening if people want to come and check that out.
And I have to ask, is this running in conjunction or in parallel with the Bright Skies exhibit with Mary Powell?
Yes. So the Bright Skies exhibit is a fantastic counterpoint visually to the Dark Skies. When you go into the gallery, it's just stunning because you have these sight lines from one exhibit to the other. And the color palettes are just exquisite. And Mary Powell's pieces are so luminous. She is just such a fantastic painter. I just can't say enough good things about her work. And she did a beautiful job with this exhibit.
And just as Dark Skies is kind of grappling with this idea of preserving the night sky as a resource and the darkness of the night sky as mm-hmm. a resource, Mary, I noticed that she kind of took up the theme of AI and is offering her work as kind of a counterpoint to that and saying there's so much natural beauty that, you know, in the craze for AI, we shouldn't lose sight of that.
And I love that. I love that because AI is really kind of owning the conversation on so many levels in the arts world right now. And I love that Mary is offering it just a beautiful alternative, something that we already have, something that's right here. All you have to do is look up.
Well, Janet, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to chat today and talk about both of these exhibitions and some of the individual works that are found in them.
Thank you, EJ. It was absolutely my pleasure.
That was Janet Fagan, an artist and curator of the new Dark Skies exhibition at the Confluence Gallery in Twisp, Washington. Dark Skies runs in conjunction with the Bright Skies exhibition at the Confluence until April 13th. As part of the exhibition, the Confluence will be hosting a panel discussion about the night sky with scientists, artists, and members of the indigenous community on Thursday, March 21st. For details, head to confluencegallery.org, where you can also view and purchase many of the works in this exhibition. We'll also have a small sampling of works at our website, spokanepublicradio.org. Just look for this episode of Thursday Arts Preview. And now, let's travel back to Spokane in the early 2000s. That's the time and place in which the upcoming short film Untouchable is set. The film is an adaptation of the one-woman comedy show by actor and writer Amy Paxton. And after a very successful crowdfunding campaign, Untouchable recently received Spokane Arts Grant Award funding to help it move from the final stages of production to the festival circuit. Rachel Baker, who's producing the film, came into the studio to talk about the development of Untouchable and why they're billing this comedy as Fleabag meets Lizzie McGuire.
Untouchable is a short film that was adapted from a one-woman play written by Amy Paxton. And it's based upon a lot of true stories that she experienced growing up. So when she was growing up, she had Perthes, which she had to take medication for that kind of stopped her growth. So she was a little bit like short growing up. And so a lot of the story is kind of based around events in which she was like teased at school, like by teachers and students. And overall, it's just kind of about her experience of like growing up and wanting to be a good person and trying to navigate the world and figure out, you know, what that's like as a young person.
And was she teased on account of her height? Is that it?
Yeah, her height is a big part of it. And then other parts of the story is just kind of like your usual coming of age experiences of trying to fit in, be cool, you know, trying to like go to youth group, be the best person you can be and figure out, you know, how to not be like a huge sinner, you know, from like age 12 or whatever. Yeah, a lot of it is, I don't know, just like a very relatable story of especially kind of like a Northwest kind of growing up experience of in like the early 2000s as well, trying to like navigate pop culture before the internet. Yeah.
And that time period is very specific to this film, and you kind of revel in that Y2K time period. So you're doing everything so that it's historically accurate and really trying to evoke that scene.
Yeah, we did a lot of like cool production design stuff, especially in the wardrobe, which was hilarious to watch because it's a little bit cringy having like grown up in that fashion to see some of that come back and stuff. And yeah, we thought it was kind of a unique time period too because, I don't know, it's a little bit more innocent than times are these days because, I don't know, we just weren't quite as self-aware, so there's still a lot of like goofiness in the pop culture and stuff.
And what are some props or some totems from that period that you think are really symbolic of it?
We had some George Bush posters hanging up in the school or photographs of him, and then some, you know, never forget 9/11 posters. So that was a little bit interesting to like look at again. And then specifically with like, you know, the clothes, especially was like the heavy black eyeliner and the weird like kind of like mid-length cardigans that you tie and stuff. And a lot of just like, especially with color, we used a lot just pinks and yellows and stuff, very like Lizzie McGuire inspired.
You say Lizzie McGuire, and the way this was billed was Fleabag meets Lizzie McGuire. So yeah, if you could talk about that that hybrid between Fleabag and Lizzie McGuire.
Yeah, there is a lot of overlap naturally because both of those are very like fourth wall breaking type productions. So yeah, Lizzie McGuire, a lot of the inspiration that we took from that was obviously the period, but also just kind of the zaniness of it. Like, we went back and watched some clips of the show, and the comedy is just really wacky and out there. And it's for young people, so it's a little bit goofy, and we wanted to lean into that. And then for Fleabag, very similar fourth wall breaking, but a lot of it just kind of diving into that internal world, especially like from a female perspective, that was really important for us to kind of explore. And yeah, we had a lot of fun just kind of playing with perspective where Amy's character, her character is pretty much unnamed, it's just girl, basically. But yeah, she gets to turn to the camera and we get a little bit of insight into her life and her internal narrative, I suppose.
And you said we, and that of course means you, and that means Amy, but there's also Kendra Ann Sherrill, who is the director. And so you are really the kind of the key trio on this. And there are obviously other individuals who are involved, but you were kind of key in bringing this all together and helping to realize this project.
Yeah, so Kendra Ann Sherrill, she's the director. And it was her and Amy originally who got together and decided to adapt this into a short film. And yeah, Amy wrote the play, and then they collaborated together to write the screenplay along with one of our directors of photography, Adam Golke. And yeah, they all wrote it, but really, like, you know, we all kind of produced it together, and it's been a very like tight collaborative process.
And what was the chronology for this? Because I think it evolved as a student piece that Amy was doing when she was at Eastern.
Yeah, we're all Eastern grads, but actually Amy did her master's at University of Montana. And then so this project was part of her thesis, and the performance of it was streamed live because of the pandemic. So it had been a couple years in the making where her and Kendra were playing with the idea of adapting it. And as people who do anything in film, they all understand that it takes a while to get things kind of off the ground sometimes. But yeah, they chatted with me in the summer of, what was that, 2022? And then eventually over the winter, we decided, you know, we wanted to do like a crowdfunding campaign because we're very used to like working without budgets and stuff. But we really wanted to have some money to play with to be able to like bring the vision to its full potential and like buy all the props we needed and rent the locations we needed and then try to pay people if we could here and there. not in glorious amounts or anything like that. And so we decided to do a Seed and Spark campaign in spring of 2023. And then very quickly after that, basically as the campaign was running for like 30 days, we did our pre-production. So it was really quick, and we basically did pre-production for like a four-day shoot that we did at Central Valley High School. And then from there, we had a couple shoots throughout the summer. So it's been actually like really quick because they dove right into editing after that so that we could try to get into the film festival circuit. So it was just kind of like a little bit slow to get going. But then once we did, it really just took off and we've been busy since then.
And Amy grew up in Spokane, didn't she?
Yeah.
So did you film at her alma mater high school?
She didn't go to Central Valley High School, but Kendra, she went to Central Valley High School. So it was a little bit of a blast of the past for her, for sure. And it was really awesome because, she's like connecting with some of her old teachers to help us get in touch with the school and get permission to film there and stuff. So it was really cool to kind of, use those community connections to make that happen. So in addition to the high school, we shot outside of the high school in a school bus. Kendra's uncle happens to be a school bus driver, so that came in handy as well. And then we went downtown and shot at the Westminster Congregational Church, which is a really cool historic location. And it was really beautiful. That was like for our youth group scenes. And we shot in the summer, and they don't have air conditioning, so we really lucked out on the weather. It was like right after our big like heat wave. And then after that, we shot at like a house that Amy's cousin owns. And yeah, I think those were all of our locations. So we very much lucked out with locations because it was all like, you know, people we knew. And some of the locations, you know, like the church and like the house, we were able to shoot there for free. So that really helped us out a lot.
And one of the things that this takes up, and I had seen this in the crowdfunding campaign, was that I think Amy talked about purity culture as a topic that the film addresses. And what exactly is purity culture?
Yeah, that's a great question. So purity culture, I think a lot of people in this area are kind of familiar with it. It's like growing up in the church and feeling like, in terms of like, especially sexual expression as a young person, that like you're not allowed to, you know, think about anything sexual. You're not even really allowed to like hug people. So like one of the jokes in the film is, you know, side hugs for Jesus. And like anybody who grew up going to youth group is really familiar with that. And it's really tough as a young person because, you know, that's like an awkward topic anyway. And so it's kind of in reference to just a lot about like the guilt and the shame that you experienced growing up around that. And it's a little bit of like a closed conversation. You know, there's kind of like, you know, here are the rules and that's kind of the end of it. And so we really wanted to explore that, specifically how it already ties into, you know, when you're a kid, like, you know, most kids, like, they just want to be a good person. So it's a lot about, the pressures of just trying to be a good person and how purity culture kind of ties into that.
And you'd also talked about leaning into some of the goofiness, and I understand a chicken suit makes an appearance in this film. Can you talk about that without giving away too many spoilers?
Yeah, it's a great creepy costume that we got off of Amazon. the chicken suit, it's basically in reference to the, it's like one of those high school, like rival high school basketball games. And so basically it's a very good like visual for just kind of Amy being a bit of like an outcast. Because she wants to try out to be a cheerleader and she ends up being a chicken mascot instead. And yeah, it's great and hilarious. And I love seeing her perform in that. And it was actually part of her original one-woman show as well. So I'm glad we got to keep that element.
And is she psyched to see it making the leap from the stage to film?
Yeah, it's been really cool to kind of see it come to life, because with the stage play, it's not only because it was produced in the pandemic, but just because it's a one-woman show, it's just a very, like, you know, singular experience where, you know, she wrote it, she performed it, it's all her own. And so taking it to a film is, it totally opens it up to be a more collaborative process with a lot of different creative influences from, you know, everybody who worked on it. And so it is really awesome to kind of see that story be at least a little bit more like visually developed with all of like the props and, you know, the period piece like sets that we try to build and stuff. So yeah, it is really cool. And I think she's super excited to see how it's evolved as a project.
And evolved it has, because you're in kind of the final stages now. I think you've got Max Harnischweger working on some original music for you.
Yeah, the cut is locked. And so Rendell Burgart, he is coloring it for us. And yeah, Max Harnischweger, he's also known around town as Water Monster, is his music project. He's doing the score, and we're really stoked to have him because he is just a whiz. Like, you know, there's been times where we needed like a little bop here and there, and he just like, he can whip it out in 20 minutes. He's a really brilliant guy. And so we're really stoked to see what he'll come up with, because the music obviously is a really important part of like bringing the Y2K vision to life. And the first cut that we did, you know, we use like stock music and stuff as like a temp score. And so it'll be really cool to see how like the character of the film develops through the music and really kind of like brings you to that time. And it just kind of adds to, I don't know, just the whole kind of goofy quality of the film, because we really want it to have a fun vibe and stuff. And I think the music's going to be a huge part of that.
And so you received this Saga grant. I'm hoping that this kind of got you over any final hurdle that you needed to, and that we can anticipate a release sometime soon. So what is the next step, and when can audiences actually see this?
So yeah, the Saga grant funds are definitely for like our finishing funds to like help pay Max for all of his time and talent, and as well for like coloring and all that stuff. So yeah, we will be sending it to festivals, and it takes a little bit of time for those to release, but we're hoping to be able to have that in the festival circuit for the 2024 like release year. And then we also want to do a Spokane premiere, so we're looking into like renting a theater and maybe doing a little bit of like a showing accompanied by other local short films and stuff, because everybody who worked on this project, not all of us, but a vast majority of us are like EWU alumni and stuff. And so we really wanted to make this like a community thing and get people kind of stoked about the potential for what they could produce in the future and stuff. So we'd love to like have some student films to show alongside of it. But we definitely want to premiere in Spokane and give everybody the first look at it and stuff, because we couldn't have done it without the community here, not only like the film community, but everybody in Spokane who's just like willing to help you out. It's a really easy place to like make short films because people are so generous with their time and resources. So we want to give that back a little bit.
Cool. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming in today and talking about this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That was Rachel Baker, producer of the forthcoming short comedy film, Untouchable. It was filmed in various locations around Spokane and also features original music from local musicians like Water Monster. It's still in post-production, but its creative team is aiming for a public premiere and festival screenings later this year. In the meantime, there's more about the film on their crowdfunding page, which you can find by visiting seedandspark.com and searching for Untouchable. This has been the Thursday Arts Preview, a show that keeps an eye on the past, present, and future of the art scene throughout the Inland Northwest. If you'd like to listen again or catch future episodes as soon as they air, subscribe to the Thursday Arts Preview podcast on major platforms like Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm EJ Iannelli.
Thursday Arts Preview receives support from Spokane Media Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering lending and banking services to professionals in film, marketing, performing arts, and more. Information online at smfcu.org.